Hello, welcome to Sonic Tonic. I'm Greg Perret, and I'm extending a very warm welcome to all of you who are listening. I'll be bringing you music, interviews, and special features from the world of jazz and blues. This podcast is brought to you by the California Jazz Foundation. It's a nonprofit that assists California musicians who have given their lives to this music but have fallen on rough times. Our podcast will reflect the talent, the journeys, and the insights of a wide range of musical artists. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a Sonic Tonic. If you've listened to Sonic Tonic before, you may have noticed that the opening underscore music for this episode is different. It's a piece called Blue Haiku. It was composed by my guest today, Jeff Gallegos, and was recorded in 2011 by his nine-piece band. Now, Jeff spells his first name with a G, so over time, his friends and colleagues started calling him Double G. Double G also created an ensemble called Daka. That's spelled D-A-K-A-H, and everything is lowercase except the K. Now, he has written for many ensembles, but for me, Daka is the benchmark for his musical journey. With Daka, Double G set out to frame hip-hop culture and music with a symphony orchestra, and not an existing symphony orchestra like the L.A. Phil, but one he would create from young classically trained musicians. That was quite an undertaking, if for no other reason than dealing with the sheer number of musicians that would be needed, upwards of 60 people. Two other composers, in my opinion, exemplify that kind of innovative and visionary thinking. They are Frank Zappa and Igor Stravinsky. I truly admire and respect that he was able to pull off organizing such an ensemble, writing the music, conducting it, securing financial grants, and securing the venues in which to perform. His story describes a truly remarkable human being. His beginnings were absolutely not privileged, but now he can claim the titles of composer, conductor, visionary, baritone sax player, entrepreneur, and, since he recently passed his bar exam, he also bears the title of attorney. Now, before I get into the interview, I'm going to play a very evocative piece he wrote called Rainy Day in East L.A. This recording is from 2007 and is performed by one of his chamber ensembles. Here's Rainy Day in East L.A. by Jeff Gallegos, also known as Double G. Thank you. Double G, what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm good.
So you ready for this interview?
I'm ready.
The last I heard was that you were going after a law degree.
Yeah, I am now a lawyer.
Wonderful. And so what kind of law do you want to practice?
Well, I've got a job now. I work for a trade organization.
Yeah.
Of cannabis businesses.
Yeah.
And so I've been doing a lot of like public policy work, and I'm reading a lot of the different marijuana laws from state to state. And we're advising a state right now on how to write their regulations based on the mistakes that other states have made.
Wow. So what pointed you in that direction? What made you go into law?
That's a good question, man. So that's actually a couple answers to that question. And let me know if it starts feeling too long.
Hey, man, no worries. Double G, you got the floor.
Sweet. So, I just kind of had always been attracted to the lawyer profession for some reason. And then when I was in ninth grade, like I was kind of an at-risk student. So my teacher, we had a mock trial. And so my teacher made me the prosecutor, I guess, because maybe they thought I was going to end up being a defendant anyway. So they sent me in as the prosecutor, and I really had fun, and I ended up winning the case.
Wow.
And so this was in ninth grade, and so this was in the back of my head of like, oh, that looks cool. And then anyway, I had a really inspiring music teacher come into my life, and then I chose to go and focus on music instead, kind of put law to the background. I know my brother was very interested in being an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, I'll go be a musician, and then, you know, he can look at my contracts someday, you know? So anyway, fast forward, my brother never ended up going to law school. And then I was on the road with Ghostface Killer, MC from Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah.
And he's actually, I think he should be an English professor, by the way, too. I call him the James Joyce of hip hop.
Wow.
So he'll kind of like flip, he'll take a word that sounds like another word and flip it to a whole different topic of conversation. I mean, it's really amazing in this guy's lyrics. So anyway, I was inspired by him just as an artist, and I've always liked his records too. So I'm on the road, and as you know, being on the road, there's a lot of downtime. There's plenty of opportunity for mischief.
Yes.
And so I figure, okay, if I just like, you know, I was like, okay, I don't want to come home just like fully alcoholic by the end of this tour, you know? And so I have to do, I find something to kill some time. I don't do Sudoku. I don't do crossword puzzles. So I got an LSAT prep book, which is a law school admissions test.
Yeah.
Just as like a brain exercise, just something to do. Cause I've always been like into reading anyway. And so I was like, okay, this will be something like a more interactive reading exercise that will kill some time. And so I started taking the practice tests, and I was enjoying, it was really fun for my mind. And then I scored the tests, and I was like, dude, I should just take this test.
Yeah.
And, so this was like 2007. And so anyway, I put that to the back of my head. Fell into C-SPAN. That was another beautiful thing about the tour, about touring, is that, you know, you'd be in a hotel room that has cable.
Yeah.
And I would watch C-SPAN. And so, like, there was these congressional hearings going on about the torture policy of the Bush administration, about the backlash at Guantanamo Bay, enhanced interrogation techniques and all this stuff I thought was pretty heinous. And so, I was getting into the committee hearings, and then all of a sudden they started having these committee hearings about finance. And this is right before Bear Stearns went bankrupt in 2008.
Right.
And they were talking about subprime mortgages. And, you know, I was looking, I'm like one of 42 people who've watched this video. I'm like, this sounds like it should be more important than it's getting right now, you know? And then anyway, the crash happened in September of 2008. And I was like, I'm running for office. This is silly. And so I put it back ahead, still just kind of putting it off. And then in 2014, my brother suddenly passed away.
Mm.
And then something just kind of shifted in my whole being at that point. I had just completed an opera. I just wrote my first opera. 2 weeks before he passed away is when I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he died, I don't know, man, like my ability to hear the muse kind of went deaf for a minute.
Wow, man, I didn't know that about your brother. I'm so sorry to hear that. I have to say, though, it is really good to catch up with you, though. I mean, we go way back.
Yeah.
I remember you coming to my place with your musical scores in hand.
Yep.
Going over music with my son.
Yeah. Working with Emil. Yeah. You know, I'm Justin, both of them, you know, I've made lots of great music with your sons. And so, you know, you're like the uncle to all of us. I don't know if you know this about yourself, but you know, we all, your Emil and Justin's generation, you know, we all look up to you tremendously.
Wow. Thank you for saying that. That means a lot to me. You know, I think your generation is pretty special creatively, and that was certainly reflected in the music you sent me. Plus, it was great to hear my guitarist son, Emil, playing on your tracks.
Yeah, that's right. Emil's on the tracks.
You know, the other thing that struck me is that as a composer, you're so thoughtful. In my opinion, you really dig deep to get down to the emotion of the piece.
Mm.
And also, you allow the musicians to express themselves through your music. That, man, that's a rare gift. I hear intelligence, I hear passion, I hear freedom. I hear music that is not apologetic or filtered. I hear a lot of courage.
Wow.
Yeah, so let's talk about these compositions. I started the show off today with Rainy Day in East LA. So what's the backstory on that piece?
Oh, sweet, man. That was actually written on a real rainy day in East LA. So how deep do you want to get on this? Because that track is part of a record that still has never been released with Deca. I lit out a couple of the tracks,
mm-hmm.
but there's a record that I started making back in 2004 called 3x13. And it was 13 pieces of music at 3 minutes apiece.
Wow.
Was the concept of the record. And this came from reading about Fibonacci and the Fibonacci series in the Golden Section. And it was very mathematical approach to a record, and I started the 13 songs I wrote for that album,
mm-hmm.
I started on graph paper.
Wow.
And so I broke it down by tempo and said, okay, by you know, whatever the golden section is, I think it was like around a minute and 50 seconds or something like that. It's whatever, it's like the number times 0.018 is how you find the golden section of any temporal piece,
right?
Which is good for movies and which is good for music, you know, because the story unfolds in time,
right?
And so I got out my graph paper and started, got a calculator and crayons and, like, you know, none of this. I mean, this, you know, usually you think, okay, I hear a beat and that's how your album starts. It's like, no, I actually busted out the graph paper and a calculator, and I was inspired by this Italian mathematician for some reason to make a record. And so that piece of music is supposed to be the closing track. I never put the vocals on there.
Mm-hmm.
I still have a cassette somewhere where I was singing all the vocal parts. And while it was raining, and I recorded the rain. It's when I was living in Boyle Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, I don't know, it was just such a beautiful sound. So I imagine, you know, the concept is that the rain is the tears from the sky, you know, and that's the concept of the song, is that the precipitation in your eyes is like the rain from the skies.
Mm.
And I mean, that was in my own personal life, it was difficult. There's a lot of people, like my neighbors, all of us living in that community, nobody's super rich. There's a couple of my neighbors were first generation, just came up from Mexico,
mm-hmm.
were hiding, you know, like trying to not get deported. This is right after 9/11 happened. And so immigration was scary.
Mm-hmm.
For people who are not documented. And now, you know, we saw how flimsy the whole policy is when Trump came into office, you know.
Sure.
He came in and just literally said, if you're Muslim, you can't come to the United States. And just like, dude, he actually said that out loud.
Right.
You know, to use a legal term, that's just completely And so anyway, so that piece of music, you know, I loved living there. I lived in that neighborhood for more than about a quarter of my life. I lived in East LA.
Oh, I remember. I remember coming to visit you over there.
Yeah. And I just dug it, man. You know, I'm half Mexican. And so I felt very much at home in that area. I don't have any tattoos. So I was able to kind of like, I didn't get singled out as being in the wrong part of the neighborhood at the wrong time.
Right.
So, yeah. And I actually made friends with the local regulatory force, we'll call them.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, they were like my neighbors and totally had my back, totally had my son. You know, when he was a baby, you know, they was like, hey, this is the new baby. And You know, it's like nothing like having a bunch of cholos have your back.
You know, it's very interesting to me that you cover so many genres stylistically, jazz, classical, hip hop. You've written for a ninet, an octet, string quartets, and operas.
Yep.
I said in my opening, though, that I thought Dakar, your hip hop orchestra, was the benchmark for your musical journey. Could you give us some background for that ensemble?
Yeah. Okay, so Dakar, we started in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a perfect timing for that ensemble. So I had been kicking this idea around since about 1995 is when I first really thought, okay, I want to do a large ensemble that does hip hop mixed with like South American type dance rhythms and Cuban dance rhythms. So that was kind of the concept. I got to give it up to Groove Collective, which is a band from New York in the early 90s. And when I first heard Groove Collective, I was like, dude, I love this, which is, you know, they're like a jazz, hip hop, live ensemble. And then the go-go scene of DC, you know, had a lot of horns and it was a very regional music. But I think that, you know, DC doesn't get enough props for the contributions to hip hop in general. So I'll say it out, you know, that I think that go-go was also a big influence for me. Just in the kind of the permission to have a large ensemble that played really funky.
Right.
And so, you know, when Groove Collective came out with their 1994 record, I was fully expecting them to do like a hip hop big band.
Right.
And they didn't do it. Same thing with The Roots. You know, when The Roots came out with their live record, I'm like, dude, this band is ridiculously amazing. And, you know, that's still one of my favorite hip hop groups of all time is The Roots. And so I was thinking, okay, well, sooner than later, someone's going to jump on this hip hop big band or hip hop orchestra concept. And I kept waiting. And though even groups like Gangstar, where they're having string sounds in the samples, Wu-Tang Clan, same thing. You know, they're using movie soundtracks that have strings. It's like they're setting up the sound.
Right.
But no one did the ensemble. So I guess in a way, it's kind of just like getting tired of waiting for the record to come out. So I'll just put one out myself because I just want to hear it, you know?
Man, I am so glad you're bringing this up. You know, hip hop culture and music, like any other art form, always becomes dumbed down with commercialization.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, first off, let me say I have no issue with any artist in any genre wanting to express themselves and make a decent living at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But the message from the business world is quite clear. Appeal to the lowest common denominator, make it familiar, and everyone will make more money.
Yep.
You know, that said, I feel the essence of hip-hop is the rhyme. And I'm very impressed because I hear the same kind of improvisational approach as jazz.
Right.
But, you know, the supporting production is more sound design than music. So, in my opinion, you brought very intelligent and expressive music to hip-hop without relying solely on beats and sound design for the supporting production. That puts you at the top of my list for having the courage to not sell out.
So that's awesome. So that makes me think of an old Mingus record that I got to give a shout to, too.
Oh, yeah.
That he did a poetry record.
Right.
Jazz and poetry, or I can't remember what he called it. It was a jazz workshop with jazz and poetry or something he did in the 50s. And so, you know, that was in the back of my head. And then also, you know, we had Rakim and we had Chuck D in the 80s. And then, you know, Nas came out in the 90s. And so there's these like really badass MCs that are already out there. Queen Latifah,
right.
You know, ridiculous. And Guru from Gangstar. And so like all this stuff is brewing in the back of my head. And so I just wanted to be a part of it in some way. I can't rap. I mean, I know a verse, but I'm not a rapper at all.
Well, man, no worries. For me, the music you write is pretty special. Now, for this episode of Sonic Tonic, I'm focusing on four tracks of your instrumental stuff.
Oh, sweet.
I'm using String Quartet number 2.
Oh, awesome.
I'm using Morbus. Is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the first pieces I wrote. I wrote that song in 1990 or 1991. So I think it's funny that song has survived. I really love how that song came out. And even though I wrote it when I was like only 20, I was like, well, I didn't want it in the set, you know, because I like it.
And then I'm using Blue Haiku.
Oh, sweet.
So I see where you use the haiku form for the structure of the song. Is that correct?
That's right. So, and actually it's two haikus overlapped over each other.
Wow.
So there's the melody, which is a 5-7-5. Ba 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 ba. ba 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 ba. That's the haiku. And then the harmony is also based on a 5-7-5 underneath it.
And then that's great stuff.
Thank you. And that, you know, it's ironic because I think Blue Haiku is one of my favorites that I've ever come up with. And it's literally a 6-bar blues.
Exactly. You know,
I've written an opera, I've written a symphony, I've written all these long form compositions. And I was like, wow, I think the best thing I did, and this is actually the goal for a jazz composer, is to come up with changes that a jazz musician can just blow
exactly
over the top of. And so those changes are kind of difficult, but if you just stick with the blues, you're okay.
Well, blues is the aquifer that fed a bunch of musical streams, jazz, funk, R&B, and rock and roll being 4 of them.
There you go.
So now I'd like to talk a little bit about you as an instrumentalist and your connection to the baritone saxophone.
Yeah, I would say that's my main instrument.
So what other instruments do you play?
So I play all the saxophones. I play the piano as a writing tool.
Right.
Like I wouldn't, if you threw changes, or especially if you threw like written piano music in front of me,
mm-hmm.
You know, you could be setting yourself up for a miserable experience.
That's like me and singing. Okay. You just don't want
to. Yeah, exactly. So I'm not a singer either, but ironically, so here's another, okay. So I play the flute, but not very well. I understand how all the instruments work as an orchestrator.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's actually, I would say my main instrument is I'm a composer. You know, I had to learn the mechanics of all the instruments. And, you know, you learn that one the hard way, too. The first time when I first wrote like a B flat to B trill on a clarinet, and I was just humiliated. Little did I know that you actually literally need a third hand to do that.
Oh, exactly.
On the clarinet.
So it's called writing over the break.
Yeah, no, you don't do that.
You don't do that.
And if you do it and you're sitting next to the clarinet player, be ready to be eviscerated.
Oh yeah. It will leave a mark.
Oh yeah. It'll leave it. I was scarred when it happened. Cause they basically one step away from laughing me out of the room. I was about 19 years old and I felt so humiliated, you know? And so.
Yeah. We need those experiences to grow.
Right.
It's very, very, very important. So I remember the last time I actually saw you was you were conducting at the Hollywood Bowl for Kumasi Washington.
Oh, sweet. So I've gotten to, Kumasi has given me some work, man. I really am thankful for him including me in those events. And same with Miles. Like Miles brought me in for another one of the, for his event at El Rey. I've gotten to conduct Kumasi twice at Hollywood Bowl, once in 2018.
So real quick for our audience, when you say Miles, it's Miles who?
Miles Mosley, the bass player.
Right, okay.
From West Coast Get Down.
Okay.
And he has his own. See, the beautiful thing about that crew is they all have their own records. You know, it's like it's literally like a United Nations of badass musicians.
Right.
And so, and I've known Miles for a long time. Like both Miles and Kumasi have played with Dakar. Mm-hmm. And Miles played Nainette quite often when we first started.
I really saw Dakar as basic training for a lot of the musicians of your generation. The genius of saxophonists from your era, Zane Moussa, did he ever play in your band?
Zane, I got to play with him in a different band. He never made it through Dakar, but you know what? I really miss that cat. I'm sad that he passed before West Coast Get Down blew up, because he would have totally been a part of that wave.
Absolutely.
Last time I saw Zane, he was playing the Bird with Strings show at Blue Whale with Miguel.
So for our audience, that's Miguel Atwood Ferguson, the great violist and composer. You know, I actually conducted that Charlie Parker collaboration with strings at a venue in Pasadena some years ago.
Oh, gosh.
Of course, Zane was playing. No one else could have channeled Charlie Parker like Zane Moussa.
Yep.
You really are part of an era of outstanding musicians. Yeah, and your 9-piece ensemble, the Nainette, man, I love that band. And I remember seeing the Nainette, it was at some program, and you played an arrangement of a Prokofiev.
Yeah.
The Dance of the Dance of the Knights.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was, that's actually my friend Abe wrote that chart for us.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So that was the concept of Nainette. So this was actually, that band was started at a wedding. I got commissioned to write arrangements, and so the family was from New Orleans, Mm-hmm. And the wedding happened in Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. And so the musical concept was wanted to bring that New Orleans flavor into the Symphony Hall. And that was another one where, okay, the event happened. I think the marriage actually didn't last either. But the band lasted longer than the marriage. But, you know, that, and so that was really amazing to see. So we wrote, like, I wrote a Stravinsky arrangement for that group. I wrote Debussy. I wrote Chopin. I wrote Satie. And I got to this other Ravel one on deck.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that was kind of like, you know, how DeKalb brought the street to Symphony Hall.
Yes.
Nynette brings the Symphony Hall to the street.
Well said, my friend. That's a great way to put it. You know, for me, your perspectives on music and art and music as art have always been second to none.
That means a lot to me. You know, and that's why I think that now I have a job that I can make money doing something else. I feel like so much less pressure around music.
Yeah, boy, I absolutely get that. I know what you're saying, but do you still have that passion to compose and perform?
So that's actually an interesting, ironic question you just asked too. Because in law school, so I'm actually one of the people that really actually loved law school. I had a great experience. I really loved my classmates I met. I was going to school with people, you know, most everybody was half my age, but I really made some great friends. And I think the legal profession is in a good position going into the future. So check this out.
Mm-hmm.
I took a class in law school. All of us have to take this class called legal writing. And, I was not a great legal writer when I first started writing. And I really had to work hard at how to really, you know, build a logical sequence. It's like composition, you know, you have to have a motif and you have to stick with the motif and you have to kind of keep coming back to it or else the listener's like, wait, what was I listening to again? And so legal writing is kind of similar in that way. And I think once that clicked in my head, it became easier for me to do. It's like, oh, this is just like writing. It's like writing a symphony, but you have to cite your sources and you have to be based in the law.
Right.
It's like basically like, you know, lifting. It's like if you were allowed to plagiarize and then just say, as long as you could say, well, I just sampled it from this, you know, it's all good. But with legal writing, I noticed that as I spent more time writing legal briefs, my composition got better because it became an economical choice. You know, you have a word count when you put a court filing in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you have to kind of get to the point.
Yeah.
You can't spend too much time yakking about it. You have to really just like drill it down. And so that kind of economic approach to writing bled over into my composition. And now, I mean, thankfully, after, you know, seven years since my brother passed away,
mm-hmm.
I'm actually hearing music again and I'm able to write an arrangement. And it just kind of back to the flow element of music. And so, you know, the irony is that since I stepped away from music, you know, I've got really good gigs through Kamasi and Miles. And then I got to premiere my opera, which was awesome. And then now I just got cast in this commercial playing my saxophone completely out of the blue from somebody who's like, oh, hey, you know, I remember you from the con. We need this for this commercial. Are you available? And here's what it pays. I'm like, are you kidding? Dude. Yes, I'm available. I will make myself available.
Well, that you were able to see the thread between the legal profession and your musical career, I think that's pretty amazing. But I do feel you have a great deal of integrity and that you're going to be the best you can be no matter what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate you saying that because that was actually, I mean, that's what I wanted to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if anybody's listening to this that is looking for business advice, that's probably not the best business advice to do that. I mean, in all sincerity, because, you know, that decision to do these, first of all, to start a band with 70 people.
Yes.
That's not a good economic decision. to play baritone sax is not a good economic decision. To write string quartet music is not a good economic decision. And so, you know, my bank account reflected that decision. And so now that's what I'm saying is like having the opportunity and really the privilege to be an attorney now. Like I don't have to worry. I can still actually just keep doing what I was doing musically. And it really, it's bringing me a lot more joy than I was feeling about 7 years ago, 6 years ago when I looked at my bank account at 45 years old, and I started getting very nervous because I was like, okay.
Yeah, but Double G, as a compliment to your business and entrepreneurial spirit, while you were that broke musician, you went out and you got funding, you got grants, and you were able to secure major performance venues.
Yeah, that's true. That was a good, and you know, that was actually good prep for the legal field as well, because you to get through some of those grant applications, you have to read and you have to, you know, you have to explain yourself in pretty clear terms. You have to show what your budget is, and you have to show, you know, you're persuading a group of people to hand you a stack of money.
Right, exactly.
And so, you know, like the grant, and I've applied for a lot of grants, and most of them I haven't gotten. But as you know, each grant, the way I look at it, even if I didn't get the grant, it was worth the time. I should say it was worth the time, because it turns out being like a little business plan.
Right.
And so that's, you know, I have this file. I still keep all my grants applications, and so I know that if I feel stuck or if I don't feel inspired, I can just pop out one of my old grants and say, oh yeah, I had this idea. Mm-hmm. You know, how does that feel? And then because you have to articulate a budget, you know, you have to kind of think through the pre-production.
Yeah.
And so the hard part is done already by just writing a business plan.
Wow. Well, my friend, this has truly been one of the most fun interviews I've ever done, truly. I was looking forward to this, and I was so happy that you were free to do this.
Can I tell you one quick story?
Absolutely. Go for it.
So this was actually, this was one of my favorite stories of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they had us all go remote for court appearances.
Right.
And I made my first court appearance at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, which was intimidating. You know, that's one of the ones where you're facing three judges on a bench.
Right.
And if you didn't do the reading, you're humiliated quickly. And so I was nervous and I was prepared, and I'm sitting there doing a sound check on my Zoom for the court. And the clerk of the court was running all the attorneys through, okay, let's see your microphone. Let me hear how you look and make sure your camera's on right. Make sure we can hear you and your internet stable. You know, all the basic like sound check stuff.
Right.
And so, the clerk of the court said, okay, let's hear your voice for a minute. And then I just started rapping. I don't know why. that one verse I know fell out of my head. I just started going along, reached the spot. We're given a lamb plot, a bucket full of seeds, all kind of different crops to drop in the soil. It's solely my decision. What will be my toil and what will be my, and so like so on and so on. And then I was watching her face, and her jaw was immediately slacked, and then it turned from a slack jaw into this smile, this bright smile. And after I was done, she started laughing out loud, and she said, you know, I've never had an attorney come in here and rap for a sound check. And so my MC, my court debut, I rapped on the mic.
Double G. Only Double G.
But we did lose the case, by the way. We lost our case. But I got to rap on the mic.
But you made a lasting impression. Oh,
yeah, that's right.
Oh, my friend, this is just perfect. Well, Mr. Gallegos, Double G, thank you. This has been a great interview, and I cannot thank you enough.
Yeah, man. And thank you.
That interview was done August 12th of 2021. Next up is Blue Haiku by Double G and his 9-Net. This next piece is Double G's String Quartet No. 2. It was performed by the Sonus String Quartet and recorded in 2009 at the Montalvo Arts Center. It's one of my favorites by Double G. It has a wonderful sense of calm and introspection. Enjoy. All right, I'm going to close it out with a Double G tune called Moribus. It is smoking, and it's with his 9-piece ensemble called his Ninette. Hold on to your seats. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening to Sonic Tonic, brought to you by the California Jazz Foundation. Please visit our website at californiajazzfoundation.org and find out how you can help make a difference in the life of a musician in need. Until the next one, this is Greg Perret wishing you all the best.